Hello, my name is David. I'm the editor of Think Magazine.
And I'm Mika, a writer for Think Magazine.
So this is going to be our last episode for 2020. And we decided to have things be a little more freestyle than they usually are. We're going to go over some of our favorite episodes of this year's podcast. And, you know, just have a little chat about them. I have a soft spot for all of the episodes.
Of course you do.
But I think I really enjoyed the first episode that we had with Alexei Tingley. Now, I don't know if it's because it's the first episode that we did, or if it's because the nature of the topic. I mean, we had quite a few podcasts where we spoke about the internet and social media, but for some reason, with Alexei, one of the things I remember the most is how, by the number of likes that you have, they can determine whether your political affiliation, or they can determine what sort of music that you like. And I found that fascinating.
I have to say, I've been thinking along a similar line, but not in terms of my favorite episode, but sort of some of the facts and realities that we had discussed. Because this was brought up in our last podcast as well with Vladislava. The detail to which these algorithms can then predict your behavior and come up with very personal characteristics like your political affiliation and estimate, you know, your lifespan.
Well, have you ever thought that maybe it's because people aren't so complicated? It's not that algorithms are really smart, it's that people aren't that complicated and it's really easy for the algorithms to figure people out.
Good point, and I think yes, I think that you're right to an extent. It's very problematic for people to live in uncertainty and live in duality and live in the gray areas. So we like to say that people are very complex and there's a lot that we don't understand, which is true. However, it is a fact that most of our DNA is exactly the same. The ways in which that they're addictive for the vast majority of the human species because our brains work in the same way. That dopamine response is going to be that same rush for the vast majority of the global human population.
If it's so well designed, or rather coercively designed to hook us, then why isn't everyone addicted to it?
Well, aren't the vast majority of people addicted to it?
Well, I mean, we could say that the vast majority is addicted, but if we're so similar, then logically speaking, all of us should be addicted to it.
Well, that kind of goes against the laws of nature, because thankfully we have something called mutations. Mutations are fantastic, because this is what gives us genetic variation. This is what gives us diversity. So you have, all the time, these little changes happening every time a cell divides, right? So there will always be people that, quote-unquote, don't fit the mold or go against some kind of identified trend, because we are different. There's always going to be exceptions to the rule.
I mean, sure, we could chalk it up to, but first of all, don't mutations take a really long time to happen?
No.
Oh, all right. I had no idea.
No.
But I think I prefer the idea that, I mean, okay, it's not about preferring one idea over another, but I think it makes more sense that not everyone is addicted to Facebook because of the way people have been brought up, for instance. In the sense, you might have people who are brought up in a very disciplinarian environment, and maybe they're less prone to be addicted to things.
I think for me, I'm kind of, my head is more around sort of this theme that I've seen crop up in several of the episodes, because I can't say that there's one that sticks out to me as a favorite. What really comes into my mind is our relationship to data and information. So even when we weren't talking about big data, And so that did come up in several of the podcasts. But even, for example, when we talk about health and food consumption, there is a lot of misinformation and there's a lot of information overload, and then there's a lot of misconceptions and a lot of misunderstanding around the data that's being disseminated. So it just makes me wonder, you know, we've got this excellent research, you know, and how do we get it out there in the right ways? I mean, obviously this podcast is part of that effort.
For me, I would agree, we have all this amazing research that's, you know, that's being conducted, not just locally, but across the world. However, I feel that we're vying for, first of all, we're vying for people's attention on social media. But what we're competing with is what worries me in particular. This idea of misinformation, the amount of misinformation that's being spread online is huge. And I think one of the main reasons for it is this idea where if there's something that we disagree with, oh no, that's fake news, let's just layer it as fake news and, you know, disregard, discredit it completely. Don't you see it even with politicians or you know, with public figures, where as soon as, instead of engaging with something that opposes their worldview, it's just immediately labeled as something, you know, it's discredited, it's like it's fake news, it's not something that we're going to acknowledge.
So you're saying that you have an issue with the fact that we are not engaging with other perspectives?
I have issue with the fact that anything that is somehow opposed to our worldview, we, instead of sitting with it and saying, okay, listen, why do people believe this? What arguments does it bring forward? What sort of information does it bring? Instead of sitting and engaging with it, we disregard it completely, not acknowledge it whatsoever.
Yeah. It's very hard, I think, to sit with the other side, you know, the other perspectives, which could be directly in opposition to what you believe in and what you stand for, to give it space and to really then try to engage with it beyond just, you know, quote unquote, sitting with it. It's a difficult thing to do. I think it takes skill.
And patience,
we don't really talk about that either. So we say, okay, but have you considered this perspective? But how do you consider that perspective? And these are conversations I've been having recently with some friends as well. In this disaster of a year, where we're having online conferences and a plethora of Zoom meetings, how do you listen? So how do you interact? How do you consider all other perspectives? How do you think in different ways? Because it's not just about thinking critically, which we all should be learning how to do, and hopefully schools start teaching that. But it's also, how do you think creatively? How do you, and I've been preaching this as well for years, preaching to a point, which because I'm not actually actively trying to implement any sort of changes into the education system for this to happen. But I do believe that we need to be exploring how we do these things. And we take for granted a lot of the things that we do on a day-to-day basis. So we're having a conversation right now. I am speaking. You are, I'm assuming, listening. But assumptions are dangerous to make, because there's also a difference between passive listening and active listening. So how do you listen actively, and what is the difference, and why is that important? And furthermore, why aren't we having seminars and training sessions on how to do these things and how to reflect? And
I mean, I'm going to be honest, I find it a little bit absurd that we need seminars and training sessions to be able somehow to reflect. You mentioned
really?
Maybe teaching. Because this is something that I believe should be developed naturally, in the sense that, you mentioned that schools should be teaching this. I mean, okay, sure, maybe there would be a class, but shouldn't this be developed, like, organically when you're meeting with friends as a 5-year-old or as a 6-year-old and you're discussing with some of your friends? Or even just playing. Well, sure, maybe at 6 you won't be discussing, but you're playing at least. And, I mean, in order to be a good sport, how to put this way, again, you have to be willing to sit down and listen to the opposing side. I think that one of the reasons why we find it so difficult to engage with other ideas is because we're so attached to our current set of ideas, to our current set of beliefs, where if our current way of framing the world is questioned, then we view it as a personal attack. So we're too attached to the ideas that we have. Whereas if we learn, if we're a little bit more distant from our ideas and we realize that when someone is attacking the argument, they're only attacking the argument, they're not attacking us personally. Let's take a local example. Every time you see two people discussing, be it on online forums such as Facebook or in person, you know, pre-COVID times, and people are discussing about local politics, then it always devolves into a shouting match. I mean, and I can't help but suspect that the reason it divorces into a shouting match is because we're so attached to our, not just our political beliefs, but in this case our political beliefs, that we can't, like trying to entertain an opposing perspective would mean harming ourselves.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting in the fact that you and I are speaking together is that you're Maltese, I'm American. The political divide is very, very similar. You've got bipartisan nation where you have two groups on opposing ends, essentially. Also the same colors, which I find very fascinating. And now it's becoming more polarized in the States. I don't feel completely comfortable discussing it because I haven't stepped foot in that country for a number of years now. But there are many people who are so devout in their affiliation with the political party that they will blindly support anyone who's from that party. They don't do any research, they don't do any questioning, they don't do any reflection. It's you stand by that party through thick and thin, rain or shine, and that's it. And then there is, I think, a lot of familial bonding around the dedication to that party as well. So you get this in Malta. And I remember when I was doing research in Cotonera, and I was speaking with this youth worker that I was collaborating with, and he said that people here, if someone in the family decided to vote nationalist or just not support labor, it is like an act of betrayal. And this is fascinating. It's fascinating because how can something like politics become so personal? And it does, because I think for some people it is an identity. And as humans, what do we need? We need to have an identity, we need to have a purpose, we need to have meaning.
But we need to diversify our identity.
Absolutely.
We need to be willing to accept that if one facet of our, I think we've discussed this this point that I'm about to bring up with Dr. Pauline Grech in that podcast, our identity shouldn't just be limited to one thing. I mean, let me give you an example. Let's say I'm really attached to my job, so on, and you know, and I view myself solely as the editor of Think. What happens when, God forbid, you know, my career stops? Then suddenly, am I left without an identity? I mean, but whereas if we were to diversify our identity and we don't view ourselves as just our occupation or just our political belief or just our religious belief, then if one of these facets falls, then we still have an identity to cling on to.
I think that having that diversity of things to identify with is also coming from people with a very privileged background, I think, possibly. It's a theory. I could be wrong. But, for example, with me, I don't even know what my identity is. On a personal level, I don't really care so much. But I have had the opportunity to travel, to make a life for myself in another country, and that inevitably opens you to other experiences and other perspectives. I think it's impossible to be able to kind of just stay in your own head with one mode of being. If you move around and you have all these different experiences, you. You've also traveled, I'm assuming. I know you spent a lot of time in Prague. But also, you are educated. And I think that having that growing up in Europe, in a developed country, and having the ease of being able to move around, and then you have people on the other end who perhaps are don't get that kind of education, never leave their town or their region, and all they know is where they grew up, and all they know is perhaps the industry, the occupation that their parents have, that they are expected to take up, and that's it.
I'm sure you're not saying that, oh, you have to be privileged to be able to have a complex sense of self. That's not what you're saying, right?
No, I'm...
You can still be from one of these small villages or whatever where, you know, and still have a very complex sense of self, right?
Yes, okay. But I think that the fact that you have multiple identities is highly, highly correlated with your privilege.
Just to correct you, I wouldn't say multiple identities. I would say multiple facets of a single identity.
Okay.
I was reading a while ago that the way our brain handles a being wrong or being insulted is strikingly similar to when we're physically attacked. It's, for some reason, our brain hasn't evolved to the point where we can, it doesn't differentiate between a physical attack and a mental attack, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And how else would we explain, like, how else, let's look at football clubs. Let's look at football clubs. Why is there such fierce rivalry between opposing clubs? It's not like, first of all, there is a huge amount of dedication between the fans of the club and the club itself. And yet, when someone else attacks their club, then suddenly it feels almost as though it becomes personal. I mean, in some cases, it might be better to offend someone's, you know, parents than offending their football club. And I can't help but think it's because we're personally invested. Let's not say attached, but personally invested into the club.
It goes back to identity, I think. If you're attacking the team that you're a fan of, it's like you're being attacked yourself. And, okay, so we've been talking about a lot of things, and I started to backtrack, and then we got into another discussion, so I'm going to backtrack. and connecting it to this thing about identity, because I think that's what we're talking about here. So being able to, as you said, separate your identity with your opinions, your perspectives, which I think is a very healthy thing to do. So when you had sort of dismissed what I said, like, we don't need that, we don't need to have training sessions and have to do these things, like listening and having dialogue, because we know how to do that. In fact, you and I are doing this now. But I'm saying that I don't think we do, actually, and I think we take it for granted. But your sort of dismissal and saying, no, we've got that figured out, and that's not the way we need to move forward. It's not, as you said, it's not insulting me or attacking me or who I am. It's a difference in opinion. Now, the reason why I'm not taking this personally, or maybe the multiple reasons, one is I'm confident, not all the time, but I am. So that's a huge player, I think, is whether you're confident or insecure. Two, because I am, as we've been talking, be able to separate what I think society needs versus how I see myself as an individual. So I don't have a lot of personal investment in what I think society needs to in this way. As in, if I'm, like, for example, running a project,
mm-hmm.
a project that was born out of an idea that I had, there's going to be a lot of personal attachment because it grew out of me, so to speak. But just saying, oh, you know, I think that we need to learn how to listen, it's an opinion. But then, hold on a second, before I forget this. I also don't think I should be so personally attached to the project, even if it's a project that I'm managing, even if it's a project that was born from an idea that I had. And then this is now tying back to the Buddhist idea that there is no self. Because really, a lot of these personal attachments, I think, are coming from ego. And what good is the ego, really?
I like what you said when you mentioned whether it boils down to being confident or insecure. Rather than confident, I would say affirmed in your beliefs. Would that be alright if we rephrase it in that way?
I don't know if that's true. Because I'm okay with being wrong. That's confidence.
I wouldn't say that that's confidence. It's like being... like. I think this is very important. You hit a very interesting note here. We have to be okay with being wrong. And I don't think it comes down to confidence, because you can have a lot of confident people who simply will not accept ever being wrong. I think we need to come up with a new term rather than confidence.
What is it then?
I mean, I don't know. We could call it blah, blah. We can make up a word. Yeah. But I think I like this idea where you have to be okay being wrong. I mean, when you stop thinking about it, what's so wrong with being wrong? How bad can it be when you're wrong about something?
There's one particular experience that I went through in my life. I was doing my undergrad in biology, and I was working as a biology tutor. So essentially, I was giving lessons to students who were studying introductory biology. And they had an examination coming up. So, of course, the students pile in right before an exam so that they can, memorize all the facts they need to memorize in this very ineffective system of learning. And I had mixed up the X and Y chromosomes. So I was telling the students that X was male and Y was female. And one of the students was like, "Isn't it the other way around?" And I'm like, "No." And then when I was having a meeting with the lecturer for that specific module, he was like, "Nika, it's the other way." And I think my face went white, because I had it drilled into my brain that as the tutor, so as someone who was like, you know, supposed to be imparting knowledge upon the students. So I had to have the answers. And not only did I have to have the answers, but I had to be correct. So it was a very humbling experience, because I can't recall how I mixed it up. But I learned that even when you're a teacher or a tutor, I wasn't even a teacher, you can't have all the answers, and you shouldn't have all the answers. And you are also learning. So it is not this one-way relationship where I am the authority figure and I give you the answers and you ask the questions and that's it.
I mean, it's funny that you mentioned that. When I was doing teacher training, it's one of the first things they told us. They mentioned, like, one day you're going to go into a classroom and someone is going to stop you. Someone is going to ask you a question and you're going to blank. Now, the last thing you should do is try and fake it. They never said you should admit that you don't know. But what they did say was like, well, actually, yeah, you can admit that you're wrong. And say, listen, I don't know, but I will check and get back to you. Or we can find out together. Because I think being a teacher, it's not just about giving people information. It's about showing people how to access this information, in the sense that, like you rightly said, it's not the teacher who has all of the answers. I mean, if we go into class and we expect this one person to be infallible and have all the answers, then how are we going to learn to be okay with being wrong? If we see our teacher saying, like, listen, you know what, this is a really good question, I don't know how to answer that, but I'm going to find out and get back to you. And, you know, you actually do come back with the answer then, or you have a lesson about the next day or a few weeks later. I think that can really help show people that it's okay to not know everything, that it's okay to be wrong, that it's okay to live with uncertainty, like we were saying with Boran's episode. You don't
Absolutely.
Need to know everything. It's it's okay to be
well,
wrong.
Well, it's impossible. And why not get excited about everything that we don't know? I mean, in one sense, it can be overwhelming. In another, I think, doesn't it make it just absolutely thrilling to be alive?
It makes life, I would say, magical. Imagine you know everything. There used to be this philosophical thought experiment. Imagine you know everything. Imagine you're omniscient. You're omniscient. You're all-knowing. How boring would life be if you knew all of the answers? Maybe one day we'll develop algorithms that can predict exactly everything that we're feeling. But until then, I think we can enjoy the uncertainty that's around us. Any final thoughts or closing remarks, Nika?
Well, it's been great. I always enjoy speaking with you, David, both on and off the record.
Oh, likewise.
And I think it's been a really interesting season, and certainly a lot of food for thought that we can bring into season 3.
Mm-hmm. Stay tuned the following year for a few one-off episodes or mini-series. Season 3 will be, hopefully, fingers crossed, coming back in 2022. We're going to take a year away from the project and kind of, you know, reimagine it a bit. So yes, lots of exciting stuff coming there. But I think we'll still be here, and you know, we'll be able to
get read the magazine, become enthralled.
Yes, get your knowledge fix. First edition coming out at the end of February, beginning of March.